everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. It's March 11, 2014, and it's time for another hour talking about my favorite subject, food, and it's going to be fun. I'm going to bring on some amazing experts in the vegan movement, and I think we've got everybody now, so let's just get the party started. I've got with me today Patty Brightman, Ginny Messina, and Carol Adams. They've all been on this program at one time or another before, and they put out a book called Never Too Late to Go Vegan. So one at a time. Hi, Patty. How are you?
Hi, Karen. Happy to be here. Thanks.
Great. Okay. We're just doing a little voice check here, and Ginny, you're with us?
Yes, I am. Hi, Karen.
Okay, and Carol.
Hi, Karen. Hi, Ginny and Patty.
Hi.
It's great to hear everybody's voice. It's amazing. We're all in different places, and yet we're all in the same place. Okay,
that was one of the most fun things about writing our book was we're all in different places, but we were like a team.
Yeah. And there's so many different ways to do it. And so let's all give a cheer for people over 50.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! I mean, who would ever want to be 16 again?
That's true.
The good thing is, I think we're all feeling good, all of us, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, thanks to our food choices, where a lot of our peers may be complaining about one thing or another, which we know, for the most part, are food-related. So the first thing I want to talk about is, in this never-too-late-to-go-vegan concept, when people are older than 50, they've got a lot of history behind them, a lot of traditions, a lot of behavior. It takes a lot of courage to change. Anybody want to comment on that?
Carol can jump in or I can jump in.
Yes, Patty, please jump.
Well, I think it takes courage to look at the truth squarely in the eye. That's what takes courage. If people were willing to look at what happens in slaughterhouses or what happens on the farms where most of our food comes from, it's just so horrendous that to me is much more difficult than switching the diet. I like to think of a vegan diet as a new cuisine. Very few of us ate food from Thailand when we were growing up. It was unheard of. And I like to think of veganism as just another cuisine. It's like you haven't had it yet, but you're going to love it when you try it. And what's really challenging to me is looking at the truth of where animals and how animals are raised for food.
But you do have to acknowledge, well, I know some people will look at it as acknowledging everything that they've done before has been wrong. And that takes a lot of courage.
I wouldn't use the word wrong.
Right.
Well, I know, but some people think of it that way.
I think the thing to say is that people have been influenced by the culture. We all were. And that something like veganism comes along and we're trying to find positive ways to help people see that what culture said was not always the best thing for us. So it's not that we were individually wrong, it's that our culture is wrong. So I think our goal is to be much more liberating about what this is about and not blaming and not looking back and saying we should have done this, we should have done that. We're saying here we are with all the strength of our experiences and all the varied ways we've known the world. Here's another way.
Right, and one of the things that we say in our book is that you can't change your past. And so it's not even worth worrying about that. You can change the future, and that's what we want to talk to people about, and that's what we want people to focus on. And that is very liberating. It's empowering.
Because with teenagers, you know, I went vegetarian as a teenager, and in some ways it's easier because it's a form of rebellion to go against what your parents are doing. I don't want to do what you're doing. I'm doing something different. Of course, that was not my motivation at the time. But, you know, that's why I think it's easier for younger people.
I think it's easy for anyone who wants to make a stand about social justice too. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to diminish. Yes, there's a learning curve. It's not easy, like snap your fingers and you're a vegan. You do have to learn a few things if you're going to do it safely and wisely, and that's why we have all the information in our book. But the fact is, almost everyone we heard from, over 50, and we did a survey of hundreds of people, everyone said it was easier than they thought it would be. Everyone ended up saying that, which really surprised us.
Yeah, although they did, of course, talk about some of the challenges, you know, some of the things that you're alluding to, Karen, about some of the challenges of going vegan a little bit later in life, you know, instead of dealing with your parents, you're dealing with your adult children, perhaps, or other family members. And these are long-time relationships that are suddenly changing around something that's really important, which is food and meals and celebrations. And so, you know, people did speak to those challenges, and we address those in the book and try to give people some tools for communicating and for handling some of the issues that might come up.
I've actually been really surprised at some older people who have improved their diets and how their children really gave them a hard time. I think anybody that wants to take care of themselves and when they start looking better, it just boggles my mind that some kids will say, you mean you're not going to make your favorite dishes anymore?
Well, one of the things we do in the book to make that easier, there are two things we recommend. One is encourage the child to make them at home. Give her your old recipes if she still wants to eat that way. But also we talk about veganizing recipes. We teach people how to take a favorite recipe and make it a kinder choice, make it without cruelty. And most recipes can be veganized.
And the other thing we say is, you know, it's okay for the parent to individuate themselves and meet their own needs rather than a grown-up child's needs. It's okay
yes.
for a parent to simply say, hey, I love this. I love you. I don't need to fix what I used to fix to convey that I love you.
Well, what I love, and I'm sure you've seen this many times, is the people that do it at an older age, how incredibly good they look after they've been doing it for a while. I've seen that kind of white, pasty skin turn into really pink, glowing skin. And, you know, certainly losing weight and just the eyes look clearer. It's amazing the transformation, how at any age the body is so forgiving and can jump in once you're taking care of it to look great.
Amen. And we do, you know, we talk about some of the advantages that people can anticipate, some of the health advantages that people can anticipate when they start replacing animal foods in their diet with fiber-rich and antioxidant-rich plant foods. A lot of people see their cholesterol go down. A lot of people see their blood pressure getting under control. Some people do lose weight. Some people don't. You know, those are different kinds of experiences. But those are nice bonuses that a lot of people who need to lower their cholesterol, who need to reverse their risk for heart disease, will gain when they go vegan.
I think one of the strengths of the book are the three chapters that Ginny wrote, the nutritional expert in our trio, and she has such a wealth of information and conveys it in such a down-to-earth way. I learned so much, and I've been a vegan for more than 20 years.
Thanks, Carol.
I did, too. No, it's amazing how we can all still learn things about being vegan, and thank goodness for Ginny's contribution, because this book teaches you how to be the healthiest possible vegan you can be.
Because we don't want to ignore the fact that this book was written for current vegans as well. This book
right.
covers issues that current vegans who are over 50 might not know or might want to know more about. This is where the richness of the nutritional chapter. Also, we have a chapter on caregiving, which is often something over 50 find themselves doing, caregiving of older relatives. So we've really tried to speak to current and about-to-be vegans.
Well, it was very current, and Ginny, you mentioned, I think, three of my favorite current subjects in the nutrition world, and I thought we might touch on each of them. One is this thing about beans and resistant starch. I'm just so in love with it. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because people need to hear more about the magic of beans and what they're doing for us.
Yeah, I know. You know, people will ask me often if they can be a low-carb vegan. And my response to that is you can cut some of the carbohydrates in your diet if you want to, if that makes you happy, if that makes you feel better. But don't cut out the beans. They're carbohydrate-rich and protein-rich and just packed with all kinds of things that are good for health. And one of the things that they do contain is that resistant starch, which is a type of starch that is resistant to digestion. And so it travels intact through your intestines, and it slows the absorption of glucose into the bloodstream, which is really good because that keeps your glucose levels more gentle and even. They raise kind of gradually, which is what we want. That's associated with lower risk for chronic disease. And it also impacts the population of bacteria, of microbes in your intestines. And it impacts that population in a good way that, again, reduces risk for chronic disease. So beans are just really wonderful. They are the only food in the world that packages fiber and healthy starch and protein all together. And so I'm very enthusiastic about beans. I'm glad to hear that you are too.
I am. And I always bring up beans when people ask about food combining, because I say, well, beans have, you know, everything in them, and somehow we manage to be able to digest them. So, you know, I'm not too concerned about mixing too many foods together.
We cover that myth about food combining in the book, and we talk about other myths. That people think athletes can't be vegan, and people think vegans have to worry about nutrients at every meal, and people think it's too expensive, and people think it's too hard. There are so many myths floating around about veganism, and the only people who believe these myths are people who haven't tried it yet. We encourage people to just jump in and try being vegan for a day, one day a week, or one meal a day. Just say, every day I'm going to have a vegan lunch. Or there's a book out by Mark Bittman called Vegan Before Six. His breakfast and lunch every day is vegan. People who try it see that there's really nothing to be afraid of. It's a wonderful cuisine, and most of these myths, all of these myths, are just that. They're just myths.
Well, Patty, you bring up a really interesting point, and that's fear. I keep learning more and more how so many decisions are made based on fear, and it's really a sad thing, and being informed and educated really can help make the world less scary.
I think the thing that we'd want to say here is that you could be vegan a day a week without knowing anything new. Yes, there's fear of learning new stuff, but you can begin this without actually having to learn much. All you have to do is examine, what am I already eating that's vegan? Spaghetti marinara, some wonderful steamed vegetables, roasted vegetables, peanut butter and jelly sandwich at lunch, muesli or oatmeal at breakfast. One of the things we're trying to do is empower people to realize that between what they already are eating and what could be veganized and the cuisines that are perhaps in their neighborhood or in the city near them, they are going to sort of have their palates explode with possibilities. So again, we want to emphasize, and a friend of mine came to my talk last week in Dallas, and he said, I went home and I told my husband, we could do it one day a week. We could do it 2 days a week. You know, that for people to see, it's not this huge step. It's a lot of small steps that are inviting, wonderful, and delicious.
So I wanted to talk about the two other nutritional things that you brought up that I thought that I'm really excited about, and that is the study that came out recently about carnitine. And, Jenny, you were just mentioning about how the beans feed the microbes in our gut in a good way, working as prebiotics, I think. Mm-hmm. And the carnitine works with microbes too in a really fascinating way. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I think that you know, that was an interesting study. There were some very, very brave vegetarians in that study who agreed to eat meat for the sake of science. And really,
yeah, I was surprised to read that, and I gave them a lot of credit.
Yeah, I know. I don't know if I could do it, but it was great that they did, because it gave us good information about the, you know, the fact that the body does the colony of microbes in the gut does change in relation to what we eat, and it is different between meat eaters and vegetarians, and it affects the way we metabolize other compounds like carnitine. And that impacts disease risk. So that, you know, that's really important because we think of, you know, we think of meat and we think of saturated fat and cholesterol and it doesn't have any fiber, and those things are all true and those things are all not especially good for you. But there are aspects of diet of animal foods that are not quite so obvious and that are new areas of research, and they really do impact health in negative ways. And that was something really interesting that came out of that study.
I want to point out something else that Ginny taught me in this book. It's not just about what we stop eating that's harming us. When we start eating all the plant foods, including beans, but the greens and the vegetables and the fruits and the everything we are eating, we're crowding out the foods that aren't good for us. And the foods that we're replacing them with are so good for us that the net gain is more than just the benefit of giving up the animal products. When you give up the animal products, there's a benefit. But by adding all these healthy plant-based foods in their place, there's an even greater benefit.
I like that, crowding them out.
Was that Mark Beckoff's phrase, I think?
Eric Marcus.
Yeah, but it's a great concept because you really don't want to think of it as renunciating other foods. You're just crowding them out with better choices, and these better choices are so beautiful to look at and so delicious to eat.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about fashion, Carol. Like you mentioned, we're in cowboy boots in Texas. And I just got myself a pair of vegan cowboy boots, and I was giving a climate change talk to 200 cattle producers in Nevada this past week, and I wasn't sure if it would be a good thing if I wore cowboy boots or not, but now I'm so glad I did, because I was very well received. But it's important to look a certain way, I think, when we're conveying a message, to fit in every way we possibly can, so that people can be open and receptive to what it is you really want to talk about.
Well, I never got my cowboy boots to fit in. I got them more to say, look, even this can be vegan. So I don't know that I'm a good example of deciding to fit in. I think the most important thing is that we are at peace with what we're doing. I don't think it matters so much what we look like as what our affect is. If we are happy, relaxed, you know, willing to talk to meat eaters, but recognizing that they've got a lot of anxieties and defenses and that we don't have to be sucked in. I wear my cowboy boots around Dallas, but, you know, sometimes I'm in Birkenstock. And so, you know, it really depends.
There are vegan Birkenstocks?
Yeah, there was one set. There was one non-leather Birkenstock that I had from years ago. Maybe they don't make them anymore. You can see I didn't wear them enough to wear them out.
Right. Okay, and you mentioned earlier about the section on caregivers, and this was really a good section. I had never read. I don't think anybody's really touched on this one and connected the dots so well about kindness and compassion, because, you know, as vegans go, especially the younger ones, I think, there's a lot of anger that goes around, especially when the veil is lifted and we realize what's going on in the world around us. It can make anybody really angry because of all the cruelty that's going on. But anger doesn't really get us very far. And when we have to take care of people, well, you might talk a little bit about that, Carol, about being a caregiver and not having expectations about changing the way people think.
Well, I guess what I would say is I entered my life as a caregiver never wanting to change them, really. I mean, or never expecting to. When you're a caregiver, you're responding either to a crisis in which you are quickly mobilizing as fast as you can to respond to a health need that has emerged, a broken hip, for instance, a broken leg, or you're responding to a chronic problem, heart disease, or in my case, Alzheimer's. And so the most important thing I found was always to have a sense of being prepared with my veganism. I knew that I would have to hit the ground running, so I always took prepared things. I made sure I picked up food on the way to the house in case I never got out for 10 days. Who knew, you know, what was going to happen?
Yep.
But the most important thing was that the love we are sharing with our care receiver is directly related to the love we feel for the world and animals. And they're all of a part. And we might not accomplish everything in a day with most of the things we need to do for ourselves, but every day we can be vegan while we're caregiving and know that that's how we're connected with the outside world, even if we're only seeing the four walls of a hospital or the four walls of a house where our care receiver lives.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, veganism was a huge affirmation, a huge connection that always reminded me I wasn't alone, even if I felt alone.
Okay, so Patty, you have had tremendous energy for so long as like the ultimate vegan cheerleader. And you do, well, it's true, and you do so many wonderful things. Now, you regularly do food demos for people.
I do. Yes, I do them frequently. And I usually pick one or two easy recipes that anyone can do and to show how easy it is.
Right. And what are typically, well, who comes to your food demos?
It really depends on who's putting them on. If it's at a bookstore, the public comes, and that's the most exciting. I'm going down to Palm Springs at the end of April, and I'm doing the weekend of the 26th and the 27th of April. I'm doing two demos, one at a farmer's market in Idlewild, and one at it's a health food store at Idlewild and a farmer's market in La Quinta. And that's just the public who's shopping at farmer's markets. And I'm going to show them how beautiful the produce is and how you can chop it up and use it instead of chips for fabulous dips that I'll demonstrate making.
Right. And you probably just blow them away. They're like, I didn't know I could do that.
It is much easier than people think. I bring some of these dips to parties and potlucks, and people are like, oh, my God, what kind of cheese is in there? And I go, it's not cheese. It's lemon juice, and it's nutritional yeast, and it's, you know, it's basically ground up cashews. And they're like, oh, my God, I never will eat cheddar cheese again. It's, like, so delicious and so easy.
Yeah, we have to talk about cheese. I'm glad you brought that up. Because cheese, well, clearly humanity is addicted to cheese. I mean, you wouldn't get the responses that you get about how people cannot give up their cheese if they didn't have some sort of chemical addiction to them.
I think there is a chemical addiction. I think Neil Barnard talks a lot about that. There are caseal morphines that are released in the brain when we eat cheese that make it addictive. But I want to say two things about that. First of all, we have an entire page and a half, almost two pages, on how to give up cheese. And I'll let Carol talk about that. But we also tell people, if you say I could never go vegan, I can't give up cheese, what about everything but the cheese? Can you give up the eggs? Can you give up the milk? Can you give up the ice cream? Can, you know, people think it's all or nothing, when in fact you can start making choices toward a kinder diet and toward a healthier diet without having to go all the way.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing is for people to realize how great pizza is, even if it doesn't have cheese on it. When I became a vegan, that's the first thing I did. I just started ordering double veggies on pizza without cheese. And I discovered that we really don't know pizza well if we're depending on cheese to convey the texture and wonderful taste. Ginny
has... Well, you're right, and that's some of the limitations we have as a culture and the food that we've become accustomed to, because when you go to Italy, there's all different kinds of varieties of pizza or focaccia, pizza dough with all kinds of wonderful toppings on it that don't have cheese.
And not just Italy. If you come to California, we have that. We have that in California, too.
But
there are pizza places that don't use cheese. Yeah.
But now we're having some exciting happenings in the world of industrial foods where we have Kite Hill. Have you all tried Kite Hill?
No.
I didn't like it. I did not like it at all.
Oh, you didn't. I liked it. What kind did you try?
I don't know, it was at Whole Foods Market, and they don't even market it with the non-vegan cheeses. It was, I couldn't find it, and I had to ask someone. He said, oh, that's for sale among the dairy cheeses.
Well,
so I didn't like it at all. I thought it was overpriced and not that tasty. The cheeses in our book, I think, are way better, tastier, more satisfying to me. Maybe I never liked that kind of cheese when I was eating dairy cheese, but it tasted kind of sour and bitter to me.
It tastes like a mild mozzarella.
It tasted to me more like, it tasted more like brie. It was kind of bitter to me.
Maybe that was a different flavor. Anyway, I'm excited that they're coming out, and they are expensive. I think it's a supply and demand thing. The price will probably come down as they make more of them. But there are lots of different varieties that are going to be coming out. And I love making the cashew base or the almond base cheeses at home. But, you know, there are a lot of people out there that just don't know where their kitchen is and they don't know where to start.
Well, there's also diet cheese made from tapioca that melts and comes shredded. They now have it in blocks, which I don't like nearly as much, but it comes shredded and it will melt on a sandwich or on a pizza. So diet cheese is widely available. I want to point out, too, there are two books out for people who want to give up cheese, two entire books on how to make your own very easy, easy, easy non-dairy cheeses. And one is like the Bible that's been out for years called The Ultimate Uncheese Cookbook by Joe Stepaniak.
Love that.
Yeah, I could never, I love that book too, I swear by it. And I don't call it cheese when I serve it, I call it a dip or a spread, and people are like blown away by it. But it mimics the flavors and textures of cheese, but also the new book by Miyoko Shinner called The Artisan Vegan Cheese has fermented cheeses in it that are so much like real cheese, like the Kite Hill. There are some I don't like because they're just too intense, and I didn't like the dairy cheeses that were that intense.
Right, yeah, I made the mozzarella in her book, and it does taste a lot like the Kite Hill version, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's got those bugs in it that people like.
The bugs that are good for your flora, I guess. But
yeah.
There's no cruelty, that's the difference. Without cruelty, we can still eat cheese, but we can take out the cruelty, and that's a big message.
Oh, amen to that, and also it's better for our health.
I wonder if Ginny could say something about umami here. And how umami is functioning and influencing our sense of what we can and cannot give up.
Yeah, I think that umami is a huge factor here. I actually don't really believe that people are addicted to cheese per se. And I like to be a little bit careful about that because we don't want people to think that they're going to be going through all of these horrible withdrawal symptoms when they stop eating cheese. I think that the bigger factor is when people stop eating cheese, they are missing this umami taste, this fifth taste that we supposedly have receptors for on our tongue. And cheese is very rich in umami, and I think that that's something that really attracts people to eating cheese. Aside, and also the creaminess, the texture of it. There are a lot of different factors there. And the good thing about this is that we can replace all of those. You know, Patty talked about making the dips or the cheese dips out of ground cashews, out of blended cashews. And that replaces that creaminess that we're looking for with cheeses. It really helps with the texture. And then using ingredients like sun-dried tomatoes or roasted peppers or nutritional yeast, which Patty mentioned also is in her dip, those are all really rich in umami. So when we start using ingredients like that to make dips and spreads or just to put on top of pizza, we're getting that umami flavor that we're missing from the Parmesan cheese or the mozzarella cheese, and I think that makes a huge difference. So that's something that we talk about in our book, about all of these ingredients that have umami, and as you're weaning yourself off of cheese, if you start using more of these ingredients in your cooking, it really can make a difference and make you miss cheese a lot less.
One of the first... miso, too, in that mix.
Miso, too, tons of umami, yeah.
One of the things that made me give up dairy, like almost overnight when I learned about it, was the inherent cruelty of dairy production. The inherent cruelty of taking the baby cow away from the mother as soon as it's born because humans want the milk. There was something so wrenching and so not right and so unjust about that, that when I read about that, that veal calves are the male offspring of dairy cows, and that we don't want the calves to be suckling from their mothers, we need the milk for humans for profit. That made me so angry and so motivated that overnight I gave up cheese, which I was very, 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 very reluctant to do until I learned that.
I think a lot of people have, once they've realized that, most people don't realize that or know it's not something that gets a lot of, it's not talked about enough.
There's a multi-billion-dollar industry telling you the opposite, that cows are happy.
Yeah, happy cows.
Happy cows, and that milk is good for you and cheese is good for you, and it's all, that's a myth that needs busting, but there's no money behind busting it.
Now, you have a section on soy. You know, there's all those myths out there, and your book really covers most of them very well, the protein myth, the soy myth, the calorie myths, and the, oh, there's just too many myths. But, you know, soybeans are just beans.
That's right. All beans are good for us.
Soybeans.
I just saw something on Michael Greger's nutritionfacts.org about the money that the soybean industry has to promote the soybean versus the other bean industries. Soybeans are very good for us, but all beans are very good for us.
Well, why? I mean, are soybeans that different from other beans?
Yeah, they're actually very different from other beans because they're a source of isoflavones, which are phytoestrogens or plant estrogens. And that's really kind of the crux of the whole discussion about soy, because there's this myth about the fact that these isoflavones in soybeans act like estrogen in your body. And the reality is actually quite different. They have a slightly different chemical structure than estrogen does, and they, in a lot of tissue, they bind to different receptors in the body than estrogen does, and in a lot of tissues they have exactly the opposite effects of estrogen. In some other tissues they have no effects at all. In tissues where estrogen has big effects, sometimes soy isoflavones have no effects. So when we start looking, when we start doing a comparison of soy isoflavones to estrogen in different parts of the body, we see that these compounds are just totally different. And you can't look at how estrogen acts in the body or how it impacts tissues and say, well, isoflavones are going to do this too, because it's just not true. But that's really kind of the core of the whole discussion about soy foods. And it's kind of unfortunate because soy foods do have these isoflavones actually have some health benefits. We see, for example, that young girls who are eating soy foods and getting these isoflavones in their at the time of puberty or in their teen years, they have a lower lifetime risk of breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Women who eat soy foods, women who have been diagnosed with breast cancer who eat soy foods, have a better prognosis. So it's really too bad that people are avoiding these foods because of this big misunderstanding about what isoflavones do.
So human estrogen is very different from plant estrogen.
Right.
Is there a different name for a plant estrogen than just calling it a plant estrogen? You may have seen this, but I've read different blogs, and very often they just say soy has estrogen in it. You don't want to eat it because it has estrogen, and everybody's just assuming it's the same as
human
estrogen.
Yeah, I think it's because of the simplistic terminology. And the term estrogen really refers to a whole group of compounds. These are all compounds that are different type. They're estrogens, plural. And they're all different. And the hormone estrogen, estradiol, that's in our bodies is just one type of estrogen. So that's where some of that misunderstanding comes in, where people think that, you know, plant estrogens are the same as the estrogens in mammals. And I don't know what we can do about that, because they are all parts of this particular chemical group.
So, Ginny, I was asked at my book signing about women who've had breast cancer, that they're being told they should not eat soy. Have you heard that?
Oh, yeah.
Over,
I know that that's
over.
that's women have been told that for quite a few years. And, you know, now this new research has come out, and the research has been done in both China and the United States, suggesting that women who have had breast cancer actually do better when they're soy eaters. And I know that organizations like the American Cancer Society say that there's no reason for women to avoid soy foods if they've been treated for breast cancer. So we're seeing a change in some of these national organizations, but I don't think that it's getting, that message is not getting down to individual doctors. That's going to take a while.
May I introduce a tone of cynicism just for a minute? This is not representative of our book, but I just want to ask a question of the three of you. Is there any reason to suspect that the beef industry is behind propagating the myths that soy isn't good for us because people need, they think they need their protein and they associate protein with beef, and the soy industry does not want us to think that soy foods are good for us? Am I totally being cynical, or is there any reason to suspect that?
Well, it would make sense, I guess. I mean, I'm sure that they're happy that people are so fearful about soy foods. I've never seen any, I don't know of any evidence that they're behind it, but it's a reasonable speculation.
Yeah, I just have a suspicious mind, and I think the myths won't die despite all the good science that soy is good for us. And I'm thinking, who stands to benefit by people not believing it? The people who are selling alternate kinds of protein in the form of animal flesh.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate that a lot of the myths are embraced by, some natural foods kinds of communities and even some vegetarian communities. So that's unfortunate, but it's certainly difficult for everyone to kind of, weed through the myths and the truth about soy foods. It's complex, and there's a lot of misinformation out there.
Mm-hmm. I think it's hard for us to be objective all the time. And if you want to promote beef, you're going to look for opportunities to support your case. And I think that's what's happening more than anything else.
I do think it's a good rule of thumb to follow the money. I mean, when you hear a message, you can ask who stands to benefit if we believe this. And with veganism, the only people who stand to benefit are the consumers. There's not any big organization behind us or a big industry trying to make a buck on our choices.
And that's a good point. And there are some people whose livelihoods, this isn't big ag or the big corporations, but there are some people whose livelihoods really depend on growing animals and killing them and selling them. And there needs to be an alternative for them if they want to get out. And, there's nothing, our government doesn't support a transition from leaving the dairy industry or the meat industry to go to organic plant industry or something like that. So it can be really, if anyone really did want to change, when their livelihood depends on it, makes it even harder.
Well, the Civil War was fought over the same issue. It's like our livelihood, our way of life. We need the slaves to grow the cotton. There is always going to be a change toward greater justice. And when it's the animals' turn for getting greater justice, there might be people whose jobs have to change or, whose careers have to change. I don't think the fact that people might lose their jobs in farming should ever be a reason why we shouldn't move toward a plant-based diet.
But people have lost their jobs in farming because of the integrated nature of factory farms. So that
Absolutely.
Many farmers are really merely contractors to agribusiness. So it's not like we're coming along and knocking something out. It's already been knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the greatest examples I've ever seen of what transformations are possible was a tempeh factory that was opened in a reclaimed slaughterhouse.
Wow. Ooh, where was that?
It was in the Midwest in the 1990s, and I wish I had kept more information on it. But it was like, we are not taking away jobs. We're creating new and different kinds of jobs. The whole fact that there are so many different vegan businesses flourishing these days, they have to employ people. They have to, and the more successful they are, the more people they employ. So, one of the things that the Quakers knew before the Civil War was that a boycott was an effective way of saying no to injustice. And I like to think of veganism as in part a boycott of an unjust system for people who work in it, the people who work in slaughterhouses, and for the animals who are being killed. So we were boycotting that, and through that boycott, creating demands for new kinds of products. So we're never just turning our back on something. We're turning our front towards something. We're always caught in a dynamic movement of change.
Amen
to that. I think you need to write another book, Carol.
Yeah, there's a book there, definitely. Okay, a couple more things. There was a new study that came out, you may have seen it earlier this week, in Cell Metabolism about animal protein in people from 50 to 65. This is a never too late to go vegan reason, that too much animal protein causes increase in mortality, diabetes, cancer. Anybody see that study?
I saw the headline about it. I didn't see the study. I saw the headline from CBS News about it.
Well, it was, yes, Jenny.
Yeah, I saw the study. I hate to throw cold water on issues.
I heard mixed things about it, that maybe it wasn't as good as it
was.
Seemed.
It really wasn't. It wasn't a very good study. I just think that we need to be careful about that kind of stuff, because there were a whole bunch of rebuttals to that study from different scientists, and they were really good rebuttals, saying why the study wasn't particularly good. And also it was an epidemiological study that was published in a journal called Cell Metabolism, which kind of raises some red flags for me, because that's not where you would want to publish an epi study. So that suggests that it was probably turned down from other journals. I think there are so many good reasons to avoid animal protein from a health perspective, because it's usually packaged with things like cholesterol and saturated fat, and, you know, the things like carnitine that we talked about. It doesn't have fiber. There are just so many reasons why replacing animal foods in the diet with plant foods is going to be good for you. So I don't think that this was a great study, but it doesn't matter too much to me, because I think that we still have the evidence on our side that vegan diets are the only ethical way to eat. They are the best for the planet, and you're always going to enjoy better health when you start eating more whole plant foods. So even though I wasn't crazy about that study, I still think we've got lots of evidence on our side for vegan diets.
And what about Al Gore? What about Al Gore? You know, we've been talking about him for a long time, because when he came out with that Inconvenient Truth, we were all screaming, how come you're not talking about the animals, Al? And he's made quite a turnaround recently.
I only read one reference to him going vegan, and it was sort of tucked away casually in an article about something else. It just mentioned Al Gore, who recently went vegan, but I haven't heard anything from him on the subject. Has anyone else?
He was recently interviewed, and he said about a year ago he was curious about it and just figured he'd try it, and he liked it, and he stuck with it.
Yeah. He said there's a little meme that's been making its way around Facebook, and one of the things that he said was that he just wanted to experiment with it, and he felt better after he started eating a vegan diet. And one of the things that he said that I thought was really interesting was that he said, I felt viscerally better. Which to me, maybe he felt physically better. Maybe he felt like his health improved. But I also sort of, and maybe I'm just reading this into it because it's what I want, I kind of felt that he was saying that the big picture, you know, he felt like he was doing the right thing. It just felt better to him. Uh-huh. And that's kind of, I don't know if anybody else read that comment that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. I thought it was an interesting choice of words, and I've been wondering about him because of that one little mention that we all heard a few months back, and now it's good to get a little clarity on that.
Yeah, well, it's really great.
Now it's the whole Clinton administration. You know, Bill went vegan first.
Yeah. Yep.
So maybe there's hope for Hillary. Maybe there's hope for more people.
Well,
there's hope for everybody.
That would give the Republican Party a whole lot more reason to not like the Democrats.
For sure.
But like they don't have enough already.
But I think that, you know, whether Al Gore went vegan or not, certainly there was a problem with him, you know, talking about the environment without including the analysis of meat eating. But I think one of the things we're trying to say in Never Too Late to Go Vegan is it's really not about celebrities, and it's really not about politicians. It's really about the choices you can make now that make you feel better, make you more connected to the earth and to animals, make you know that you're adding to compassion in the world. So one of the things we did is we interviewed a variety of vegans over 50 to listen to their stories and to show the varieties of ways in which vegans are living in this world now. So, I mean, I would just say one of the things I love about the book is the way different vegans speak about their lives and what it meant to them.
People have told me that's their favorite part of the book, is reading everybody's stories.
Yeah, I've heard that too. And the people who shared their stories with us were so honest about their struggles and their joys of being vegan. And I think when we were writing the book, it meant a lot to us to read those and to be able to use them. And yeah, I think that was a really special part of our book.
People love stories. People love individual experiences. It certainly makes it an easier thing to read when you're talking about nutrition and things that can be a little dry. To read personal stories makes all the difference.
Last week I met Donald Moy, whose story is after Chapter 8. He came to the book signing, and he was just such a lovely person to interview. And I invited him to say a couple words, and he stood up and he said, "So, you know, it turned out that after Carol interviewed me, everybody was going to know I was over 50. So it was so cute. But again, there's a famous saying by George Bernard Shaw when he turned 80. George Bernard Shaw was a longtime vegetarian. And everybody said to him, "Well, you don't look 80. And Shaw said, "Actually, this is what 80 looks like."
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was saying to Donald, well, this is what over 50 looks like. This is what people don't realize, that you can look this great because you've liberated yourself into a way of living that's, you know, you're not having to deal with visceral crises like Al Gore said.
Right.
Well, that's just like when people see someone who's slim and probably at their ideal weight, and everybody's going, they're too thin, because we're used to people being overweight all the time.
Yeah, it breaks my heart up when I teach my cooking classes. So many people come who've already been diagnosed with a heart condition or with cancer, and they're trying desperately to change their ways, which is great. But I wish we could tell people, don't wait. Don't wait for that scary diagnosis. Change your ways now, and you'll reduce the odds of having it. And even if you have a disease, your odds of recovering from it and living long after it are greatly enhanced when you're eating, you know, the healthy plant-based food.
Absolutely. Now, you've got more than 75 recipes in this book, and the vegan cuisine is just over the top these days. It's just totally expanding, and there's so many great books out there. How did you choose to put the ones in your book?
Before we get to that, I want to point out that we recognize not every vegan likes to cook. And so we have lots of ideas and foods and recipes for people who don't cook. So we teach you how to eat vegan even if you're not going to cook. So I just want to say that before we talk about recipes.
Okay.
I said
that's
it.
That's probably most people. People like watching food shows and watching people cook, but they really don't want to do it themselves.
Exactly.
One of the things that we did, Patty and I originally were going to write a book called What Do Vegans Eat? And we had answers from more than 200 people. And some of them described meals that people raved about. And I had written to them and said, would you send me the recipe? And when we interviewed people for this book, when they talked about meals that people raved about, we said, would you send us the recipe? So some of these are recipes from longtime vegans who've tried these recipes, made them their favorites, and we felt they had done a lot of testing on recipes, and they were very reliable. We wanted to include these sort of representative, down-home, delicious foods. We also wanted to include foods that were among the ones that Ginny recommends for people to be eating, ways to cook leafy greens, ways to include beans in your diet. And then we had a third section where we wanted to show people how to veganize some of their favorite foods. And so we have vegan ricotta, vegan Parmesan, mayonnaise. And then we wanted to have every kind of sort of appetizer, soup, salad, dessert represented as well. And before we knew it, we had more than 75 recipes.
Way more than 75. We had to cut it back for space in the book.
I'm not surprised. I love my food. I love vegan food. I'm a foodie, and there's just too many great dishes out there. There's just too many great dishes out there to have to go to the trouble to grow plants, to feed animals and slaughter them and feed people and create all kinds of environmental degradation. It's just nutty.
It really is nutty, because you're right. Choices for people, whether they like to cook or whether they don't, or if they just want to cook some really fast meals, it's just unbelievable. When I go through Pinterest and see all of the recipes or food ideas that are on there, or you just do a Google search, it's really incredible. Vegan food is just amazing.
I want to quickly mention something a friend of mine is doing. He took a picture of it and sent it to me because he's so excited. He's moving toward a vegan diet after a heart episode. And he said that what helps him not have any kind of cravings is he keeps beautiful colored bowls all over his kitchen with different vegan snacks in them. So he'll have some walnuts, he'll have some raisins, he'll have some, pumpkin seeds, he'll have some dried cranberries or figs or dates. He just keeps different foods around the kitchen. So when he wants to eat something, there's something healthy to grab.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, I love that.
I think that means we just need to plan ahead and be organized and be prepared. And that's how we can be most successful in everything, especially changing our diet.
Right.
Because when you're hungry, you'll grab anything, and you want the right thing to be there.
And speaking about being well prepared, we just want to tell your listeners that we do have a website, Never Too Late to Go Vegan, and it does list all our book signing events and where we'll be speaking. So if people want to catch Patty doing a food demo or Ginny talking, you know, we've got a list of where we'll be when on the website, Never Too Late to Go Vegan.
Okay, I didn't know that. I will update my page on you and put the website in there. That's good news. Well, thank you, all of you, for joining me. This is a wonderful book, probably a great Mother's Day present, a great Father's Day present, a great present for anybody who has everything and except knowing about the things that they should be eating. It's a very, very good one. Thank you for doing it.
Well, thank you for having us on.
Yeah. It's great to talk to you again, Karen.
I just wanted to say this was The View vegan style.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to be one of those stars on The View.
That's right.
We need to have
one of those, but there are, you know, some wonderful women in this movement, and you are it.
It takes one to know one, Karen.
Exactly. Okay, thank you. And
thank you.
All right, we just have a few minutes left. And I just wanted to give you a very brief update. As I mentioned before, I was the lone vegan at a livestock company's bull sale this past weekend in Nevada. And I spoke on a panel about climate change. And I'm hoping in the next few weeks that I'll be able to post some of the information that occurred during that event, some of the talk and some of the things that I learned. But it was really a fascinating event, and I'm so glad I went. I was, like I said, the lone vegan among about 200 cattle producers, and I know that I planted some seeds. But it's really a challenge, as I mentioned before, about people who are afraid, really, to change their ways and change their livelihood. And I know there isn't going to be all winners when we move to a better place, unfortunately, but in some ways, if they do change their diet, they will be an absolute winner. But being in Nevada was a fascinating place. I don't know if you've been there before, but I went from San Jose, California to Yerington, Nevada, and watched the environment change dramatically so many different times, ultimately getting to Nevada, where I couldn't imagine anybody living there because it was so stark, full of sage, and so dry. And people just kept saying all that they could do there was grow cattle. I thought that was kind of an interesting comment because it was really hard for me to believe that cattle could actually live there without the aid of humans bringing in all the food and water for them. So I don't think that all those cattle that are living there could really just live there naturally. But it's interesting what people will make themselves believe. Okay. So now, moving forward, there's a lot of work to be done. And we're doing it here at ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. So I hope you'll visit that website. Of course, you know we've got great recipes there as well. And what else? I think it's time to quiet down because that I don't have any more time left. Okay, so thanks for joining me and have a very, very delicious week.